from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 12, recorded Monday, April 3rd, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by ExceedZip for .NET, which lets you handle zip, tar, and gzip files on FTP servers, in streams, in memory, and more. Online at shrinkster.com/dt2. And by peterbloom.com. Start with better controls, finish with better sites. Online at peterbloom.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott covers the top 10 coolest Windows utilities you don't know you already have.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes. I'm here with Scott as always, but this time I'm recording from my hotel room in Orlando, Florida, just as the fireworks start at Epcot, right 5 miles away from here. What do you think about that, Scott?
Fantastic.
So what are we talking about today?
Well, this is the top 10 little-known Windows utilities slash features that you may already have, in the tradition of having really long top 10 list names.
All right.
Full stop.
This ought to be great.
So we're going to go in increasing order to the ones that this actually are not an arbitrary order. I'm putting the ones I think are cooler towards the end. So that way you're on the hook to stay around and find out what's going on.
Okay, great.
So, obvious and simple first one is, or number 10 rather, is dragging while alt-tabbing or dragging to the taskbar. A lot of people don't realize that when you start a drag, you pick up a file or you pick up a folder, you can drag with one hand. So you've picked up, I'm dragging right now, I'm not letting go of my left mouse button. I can actually alt-tab. So I can pick a file up off my desktop, alt-tab, go over to Outlook, go over to an email, go over to Word, and then drop the file directly on the drop spot.
Very cool.
Seems like a simple thing, but I watch a lot of people moving their windows around, trying to get things prepared to drag.
That's right.
You've already got all this stuff in your task list. You can just alt-tab and drag. And then
I know that if you have a window in the foreground and you drag a file from a window that's in the background, it will stay in the background, so you can drag it onto it.
Yeah. You can also
I didn't know you could alt tab.
Yeah, and you can also drag down to the taskbar. Don't drop, because you can't drop things in the taskbar. Drag to the taskbar, hold, and then as you hover over the thing on the taskbar, it will jump to the front, then you can go back up and drop directly onto it.
Wow.
I use that all the time.
I didn't know that.
That is some wacky wild stuff. I understand you can drag to the taskbar. Very cool stuff. Number 10.
Cool.
Okay, number 9 is a little perplexing, and actually number 9 wasn't on the list, and then I was at Mike Gunderloy's site at larkware.com, cool site, and he had a link to someone called iColor Folder. This is a folder coloring tool at shrinkster.com/dpf. It's a whole utility dedicated to the ability to change your folder's icons.
Wow.
Pause for effect. But this is already built into the shell. You can right-click on any folder you like, any folder. I'm right-clicking on a folder on my desktop right now. Hit Properties. Click on the fifth tab that says Customize, and there's a section that says Folder Icons. You can change your folders now. I do this now. A lot of people see my really colorful desktop. I like to have different folders of different colors that mean different things. Because if you've just got a whole desktop full of manila-colored folders, yellow-colored folders, it doesn't really tell you anything. There's like 32 times 32 pixels completely wasted that could be giving you some information. So I'm not quite sure. And then I realized when I read the FAQ about this particular utility, it said, and we don't stay resident in memory. We have a very low footprint. And I realized, well, they're just writing to the same file that Windows Shell writes to, the desktop.ini file. When you make a change like this, there's a hidden file called desktop.ini that refers to the icon of your particular folder. So this may be a shiny utility and wonderful. I don't use it because it's built into Explorer. So folder coloring is a really great way to get a productivity gain. And actually, I'll probably blog about this and put up a bunch of my colored folder icons so people can jump on the colored folder wagon that the Mac users have been holding over us for the last several years.
Excellent.
Cool. Number 8. You remember Subst? S-U-B-S-T.
Yeah, what is that?
Subst is substitute, like substitute drive.
If you type subst, that's right. That was the DOS command, right?
Yeah, it's a DOS command that's still around.
Yeah.
And subst lets you say, I want to make this path a drive. So you could like say subst T colon space C backslash temp, and then suddenly the T drive would become your temp drive.
It's all coming back to me.
Ah, yes. Whatever happened to subst? I don't know. The thing about subst that's cool is that if you bring up an Explorer window and you've got the .NET framework on your machine, if you go to C backslash windows backslash assembly, you're going to see the GAC, right? You'll see the global assembly cache. And what you're going to see, though, is a lie. Okay? That's not really a directory. If you look at your columns, you're seeing a lie there. You're seeing assembly name, version, public key token.
It's a shell extension.
It's a shell extension, exactly. But if you go out to your command line and you type, say, subst G colon C colon backslash windows backslash assembly, and then instead of visiting C windows assembly, visit the G drive, the newly created G drive, you will see what's really in the GAC, the underneath of the GAC. They won't That's know cool. enough to give you the lie.
Very cool.
So what's cool about this is that sometimes you need to debug stuff that's in the GAC. You've already added it to the GAC, but you're doing some development. So you need to add your PDBs, right? Your program debug files. And they have to be in the GAC along with the actual files so you can debug them. So if you subst a drive to the GAC, you can then sneak in there, see the real directory structure, find your files, put your PDBs next to them, and you can debug items that are already in the GAC.
Very, very cool.
Shiny.
It's a great nice. Use of that technology.
Totally. Generally, I don't like subst. I know a lot of people use it for their build drives. They're like, everyone has to build on the Z drive, and then one guy might have C dev foo, and the other guy's got C projects foo, and they all subst their drives to it as a way of finding common ground. Instead of using subst, I like to use junction points, or what's also called linkd. Junction points are something that you already have built in. This is something that NTFS always supported, except there was never a utility to get to it. The Windows NT4 resource kit and the Windows 2000 resource kit included a command line utility called linkd, but the best one is a thing called junction that you can get from sysinternals. Everyone loves sysinternals.
Right.
And then a while back, my buddy Travis Illig made an icon that would show up in Explorer so that these junction points, these folders that point to other folders, would have a little chain indicating that they're a junction. But he talked to a guy named Hermann Schnagel. Schnagel? S-C-H-I-N-A-G-L. I'm a good German with the last name Hanselman, but I don't know how to pronounce this gentleman's name. Schnagel, oh, wow. I'm not sure. Hermann created a great thing at shrinkster.com/dpg and actually incorporated Travis's suggestions and created what he calls the hardlink shell extension.
Huh.
This is a utility that lets you actually right drag from one folder to another. And then when you right drag and let go, he'll pop up an option to say, make a junction here. So this allows you to write your build files, your batch files, your MS builds, all your different builds, relative paths. So like, for example, we've got an SDK that we use and everyone's got it installed somewhere different.
Right.
So with our builds, I like to make a folder called SDK. And then the person who's doing the build, no matter where they've got the SDK installed, they just make a pointer to it, a junction to it.
Yes.
This is something that's built into the file system.
Very cool.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Which actually brings me smoothly into number six.
Before we get there, I want to ask you, you've done some shell extension programming yourself, right?
Yeah.
I was just thinking that might make a really good DNR TV episode.
It would. You know, shell extensions are really powerful, but there's one thing that I think Microsoft and that everyone is really punting on right now is that you can only have one version of the .NET framework loaded into a process at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if I write a shell extension in .NET 1 and you write it in .NET 2 and we try to live together?
Hmm.
9 times out of 10, it works just fine. But every once in a while, probably my shell extension, the 1.0 shell extension, or the 1.1.1, won't work if 2.0 gets in first. So there's some really cool stuff going on right now about shell extensions. There's a company that made a shell extension maker that literally like made it integrated into Visual Studio.
Really?
Just go file new shell extension. But I think that people are kind of missing the point that there's three versions of the .NET framework out there, and you really just don't know which one's going to get in memory.
But if you target 1.1, you're probably pretty safe, right?
for the most part, as long as your shell extension doesn't do any remoting outside. I've worked with a shell extension from Logitech that did some remoting, and there's problems remoting between 1.1 and 2.0. And you'll get this really obscure error that says date time min ticks something something is not compatible. It's kind of like the classic
sort of
remoting
like a
error,
version incompatibility.
And that's showing that there's a compatibility problem. But yeah, for the most part, it'll work. But I just wanted to warn people that when you're making any kind of extension, whether it be inside of like MMC or it's Explorer, if you don't own the executable, then you can't count on the right version of the .NET framework.
Let's just
so
put that
right.
aside for another day, and we could do a DNRTV on shell extensions. Would you?
Totally.
Cool.
Totally. So the fact that Hermann's shell extension uses right dragging, that means dragging with the right mouse button and then letting go, gets me into a cool little known feature number 6, which is right dragging. There are so many places where you can drag something and drop with the right mouse button and get a different feature. I mean, the obvious one is, of course, is Explorer. If you pick anything up in Explorer and right drag it, you'll get move, copy, create shortcut.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize that this works in Outlook and Word. You can like go into Word, type a bunch of words, select one, and then right drag it. And you'll actually get a context menu about moving, copying, or linking to that word.
Wow.
A lot easier than the whole cut, copy, paste, paste special thing. And really, right-clicking and right-dragging will set you free no matter what you're doing.
That's cool. Something you don't really think of that much. I know for new Windows users, it takes them a long time to get conditioned to the right mouse button, you know, get used to it.
Because it's not discoverable.
I'm talking mere mortals here.
Yeah, but it's reasonable though, because it's not discoverable, right? Why was the start menu added to Windows 95? It's because a monkey will never double click. Right? If you go into like program manager in Windows 3.1, there's not discover. Oh, double click. Oh, that's so obvious. Triple click. You know, that's not obvious. Like if you go into Word, right? Double click will select a word, right?
Yep.
You know that. You can go and double click, get a word. If you triple click in Microsoft Word, what happens? Selects the whole paragraph,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally discoverable, right? Completely obvious. But quadruple clicking doesn't do anything. So these kinds of UI things are not particularly discoverable. But once you do find them, it's very powerful.
Yep.
So the next one is number 5, Windows hotkeys. And I mean specifically hotkeys that use the Windows key.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff Atwood.
Like Windows E brings up Explorer, for example.
Exactly. Jeff Atwood actually listed them all out at shrinkster.com/DPH at his very, very good coding horror site. And he's got a list of all
horror?
Of them. Coding
horror.
H-O-R-R-O-R.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah, shrinkster.com, not coding horror. Thank you for taking it there.
No, I wasn't going to say that. I just didn't hear you.
I took it there then.
Okay.
Shrinkster.com/DPH. Jeff Atwood's a fantastic writer, and his site is a gem. I read it every day. And he's got a whole list of them up there. And he points out that where those keys end, like window E for Explorer and window M for minimize, WinKey, which is a utility that specializes in making the Windows key bindable to other things.
Right.
Is a great thing. Turns out that the company that makes WinKey is no longer distributing it. But I found a download at shrinkster.com/DPI. So grab yourself a copy of WinKey and know that it's no longer supported, but it's rockin' sweet. And squirrel it away, because one day you won't be able to find a copy anywhere online. Turns out the company found it too much of a support burden, so they decided to move on to other things.
Wow, great tip.
Yeah. Okay, number 4 is command lines other than command. Right. Now, we talked about Monad in our last show?
Mm-hmm.
So, Monad's an obvious example, but it turns out there are other shells, command line utilities within Windows that exist already. The first one is a thing called WMIC. So, if you go out to the command line, you go out to cmd.exe, and you type in WMIC, you'll get a Windows Management Instrumentation shell. This is a shell that just does WMI.
Cool.
So you can go out there and type queries and things that you would be ordinarily having to write a WMI program to do. Like you could say process where description equals explorer.exe, and you can get information about the explorer.exe process. You can poke around all throughout the WMI namespaces and see all the information that's there. It lets you browse schemas, query all the different classes. You can work with remote computers, make aliases. You can write specific scripts.
Wow.
For an administrator of a large network, it's just one more thing, one more arrow in your quiver. And I was totally surprised. It's like whenever you type something at the command line and you see a result that you've never seen before, and you didn't realize it was installed that all the while, it's pretty cool. It's like discovering, you know, discovering gold.
Absolutely.
So that's WMIC. That's at trinkster.com/DPJ.
Okay.
I had never seen that one before today. Did you?
No, I never heard of it.
Yeah, it's crazy. NetSH. This is a good one. I'd actually use this one, but not to the depths of what it can do. NetSH, shrinkster.com/DPK. This is a tool that lets you do all the kinds of things you would do from the network interface properties window from the command line.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go type NetSH. You could say add server and then add a DHCP server. You can go, if you wanted to like uninstall IPv6, sometimes that can screw up people's machines. I've got information up at shrinkster.com/DPL. You can type NetSH interface IPv6 uninstall. But the most useful thing I found that you can do with NetSH is I actually got my system into such a boogered up way that when I ran ipconfig from the command line, it did nothing.
Yep. Hey, here's a nice little tip for you with ipconfig.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, sometimes you'll have a bad DNS entry because you're working on sites and editing DNS entries, and you go in there, something gets in there that's wrong, you go and change it in a DNS server, and it doesn't change in your on your client because of the time to live and all that stuff. So there's a local DNS cache associated with your connection. If you type ipconfig/flushDNS, it'll remove it from the cache, clear
that's
the cache.
That's kind of the control F5 equivalent,
absolutely.
Right? You know, bust through that. Don't, you know, trust me, I want fresh DNS. Absolutely.
Right, absolutely. And I'd like to remind everybody that Hansel Minutes is made possible this week by XSeedZip for .NET, which lets you handle zip, tar, and gzip files on FTP servers, in streams, in memory, and more. Online at shrinkster.com/DT2.
NetSH will let you reset your entire stack. So you can say NetSH interface IP reset. And this has saved me two or three different times when I got my system into all sorts of weird states by basically rebuilding my whole little IP stack under Windows XP.
I could have used that tonight. My connections weren't working at all, and rather than having to log off and log back on and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, totally.
And you can read Scott's post about that at shrinkster.com/DT1. So what's next?
So moving on, we're getting into the top three here. From the command line, are you familiar with pushd and popd?
No.
So go out to the command line and just, you know, what directory do you drop into? Probably documents
usually
and settings,
documents,
Carl.
Documents and settings, yeah.
Okay. So go and say like pushd, all one word, space, and then a period.
Okay.
And then cd off into like the Windows directory, right? cd/Windows.
Okay.
So then you're kind of off doing some stuff, and then you go and say popd, just popd, and then hit enter.
Cool.
There's actually a stack of directories where you've been.
Huh.
So you know how a lot of people write batch files that keep track of where they are, and you have to go cd... /... and you do all this dancing. With pushd and popd, sometimes you just want to go back to where you were.
Great.
Now, the cool tip on top of that is setting your command prompt differently. And Craig Andera turned me onto this, and I've got this up at shrinkster.com/DPN. You know how people used to customize their command prompts in the DOS days?
Right.
You can still do it now. If you say set prompt equals set prompt equals $P, where P is path, $_, where underscored means new line, $+, plus sign is going to tell you the depth you are within the stack. And then $G. Again, all of this up at shrinkster.com/DPN. If you type this prompt, you'll actually get a plus sign right before the greater than that you're used to seeing that will show you how deep in the pushd stack you are.
No kidding.
So then you can see pushd, you'll see a plus, pushd again, you'll see a second plus. This lets you write very robust batch files where you can get right back to where you were before and not have any trouble because you CD dot dotted one too many times.
Dude, that is sweet.
Yeah, so big thanks to cool. Craig Andera for that tip, shrinkster.com/DPN.
That's awesome. I'm going to use that tomorrow.
Oh, see, this is what the minutes is for, man.
Right.
I'm going to use that tomorrow. If I can help, yeah, if I can change the life of just one child here on the minutes.
Teach a man to fish.
Yeah, dude, totally. And then within number three, because we're talking about moving around with directories and stuff, you know, you just can't say enough nice things about tab completion, right?
Okay.
So, like, we're down here at the command prompt, and we're doing push D and pop D, and one of the things that just cannot help you too much is the tab completion stuff, right? We've all remembered early versions of Windows 2000 where we'd go into the registry and set the tab completion character ourselves.
Right.
But Patrick Caldwell reminded me today that how many things the tab completion can do for you. You give it just the slightest hint that what you want to do, and you hit tab, and they'll help you out. You type CD, you know, DOC, and you hit tab, it automatically puts in C:\Documents and Settings, all in quotes,
wow,
all correct for you. And then, of course, shift tab gets you
wow
to the other options, tab and shift tab.
That's cool.
A lot of people think it's just a simple step forward, give you some auto completion, but it's so much more. Also, the depth of wildcards that it'll take. You can say star foo star, and you can find directories or files where foo is in the middle.
Ah.
You know, sometimes you don't have full wildcard support, but the stuff at the command line is just very well enabled for command line support. Anything DIR understands, it will understand.
Cool.
So yeah, if you use tab completion, but you don't think you really use it to the fullest, that alongside push D, pop D, and a customized prompt can really make you a ninja at the command line.
Absolutely.
Cool. Number two, people may not think this is an appropriate number two, but I think it is because I'm all about the big fonts, right? Changing your console font. You know how you can bring up a command line and you go and click in the upper left-hand corner there and say properties. You get a choice. You get this really lame choice between Lucida console and then some bitmap fonts from 1985.
Yeah.
You can control what goes in that font window. If you've got another monotype font that you really like, maybe the font that you use for programming with, you can modify the registry and get your own fonts in there. And I've got details at shrinkster.com/DPO. And George Riley actually expanded on that and made a registry key that makes it even easier, a registry file that you can run at shrinkster.com/DPP. So a lot of people have been stealing like the Consolus font from the Longhorn disks or from Office 12. If you search for programmer font on Google, there's a million different monospaced fonts. You know, you're not relegated just to Courier New. So I would encourage people to check out in, you know, customizing their environment. I like to make my font, I use Consolus. I go black background on a green screen. I use a 24-point font because I want those dots to work for me, man. High DPI.
Shiny.
Very.
And the number one cool utility and or cool thing about Windows this week is
all the million other command line utilities that you already have but don't know about.
Wow.
I was writing up a list of these myself, and I went up to Google to check on one of them and discovered shrinkster.com/DPQ, which is a list of all the crazy utilities you've never heard of that exist already on your system, including ones that aren't documented.
Now, these aren't things that you have to download. These are already...
No, these are already on your system. You have these now. So why don't you go out to a command line? We'll do them together here.
Excellent.
So the first one is fsutil, file system util.
Okay.
All sorts of things about managing the volumes, managing your disks, file-specific commands, file system information.
Now, these are behavior. Guaranteed to exist on what?
On Windows XP in 2003.
Okay.
Yeah, so like, for example, I mean, it might be something as simple as fsutil space fsinfo space drives gives you a list of all of your current drives. That's pretty simple, but there's lots of different other things like fsutil fsinfo volume info. You get details about all of your different drives, whether or not they support case sensitivity, whether or not support Unicode in their file names, whether or not they support ACLs, whether they support compression. It's a capability querier of your file system, fsutil. These are all things you could put into your batch files and your various utilities because you can count on these being there all the time. So here's another crazy one. If you go to your command line and you type eudc edit, this is a thing called the private character editor, eudc edit. This is actually a weird, I had no idea this was on my system. This is a utility that you could actually build your own font from. It's a private character editor. So I'm not really sure quite why it's useful or interesting. There's lots of other font building tools, but I always find it creepy to know my machine completely and then discover an application that I had no idea existed. And this one has a full UI for editing fonts. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, totally.
Wow.
Some useful stuff that you can use on like your mom's machine or a machine you come upon that's maybe boogered up is you can type SFC. It's the system file checker. This is the thing that will go through all of your Windows protected system files, and it will basically overwrite and replace the quote-unquote incorrect versions with Microsoft versions. So if you think that you've got a machine that's been compromised or has got an invalid driver on it or somehow has become corrupted, SFC is a tool you can use to scan your system either on boot or scan immediately and potentially bring it back from the brink.
Wow.
And then within the context of drivers, if you type driver query, just one word, driver query from the command line, you'll get a complete list of all of the drivers that are running on your system. And there's all sorts of things if you type driver query slash question mark that lets you basically enumerate and list all of the different installed device drivers and their properties and even output them as a CSV file. A couple of other quick utilities. Disk part is a disk partitioning tool, another kind of hidden command line that you can use. Very dangerous. Don't hurt yourself.
Yep. Use that one.
Yeah. Open files apparently will let you see all of the different files that are open on your shares.
Nice.
And you can also enable your local file tracking so you can see all the open files on your system currently.
Awesome.
SC, service control, is like a net stop or net start on steroids. It lets you manage services and control services from the command line. And then the last one, which I thought was kind of cool, is get MAC. GETMAC lets you basically get the MAC addresses.
Yep.
You know, I always do ipconfig slash all, but now get MAC just does it and tells you the status of those particular interfaces. Pretty cool stuff.
That is sweet.
That's our number one thing, a million other command line utilities that you already have.
Very cool, Scott. Anything else?
Yeah, so I wanted to give a shout out. I saw a pretty interesting site that Jonathan Goodyear's company is putting up called Email and the number 2 Face. So it's emailtoface.com. And this is a pretty clever idea. I'm not sure how they're going to get everyone in the entire universe to put their email addresses and faces up there, but they're basically storing a mapping between your email address and your face. So
nice.
You go up there and you add a small icon of your face, maybe the one you use for your instant messenger. And I think that they could probably come up with some cool and creative ways to integrate this with Outlook or different messaging tools. When you have an email address and you just want to see that person's face, you know how Outlook's contacts form lets you put their face in?
Right.
It'd be pretty slick to have like a web services interface or maybe like just a simple HTTP GET where I could get someone's face from their email address. So check out Email to Face.
It's not a real security risk because it's not so high resolution that it's any sort of...
Yeah,
software.
It's not like it's not email to headshot.
Yeah, it's not email to high-res retinal scan.
Exactly. Email to fingerprint, although I've got that idea patented right now.
Patent pending. Scott, this has been a fabulous show. Thank you so much. Great stuff, as always, and makes me wonder how many more of these shows you got. I mean, there's a finite number of cool things in the world.
Is there? So. Is there, Carl?
We'll have to wait and see.
Who hurt you, Carl Franklin? Who hurt you? I think I've got a few more in me.
All right. Until next week, this is Carl Franklin, Scott Hanselman saying thanks for listening and have a great week.